This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Davis Hammett. He is an activist and founder of Loud Light. Loudlight.org is the website. Davis, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We had Greg Palast on yesterday talking about this. I think it's worth revisiting. You guys are, you're on the ground in Kansas?
Yeah, I live in Topeka, Kansas. I could throw a stone in that would hit the state house here.
Okay. So tell us what happened in the primary election where Kris Kobach, the notorious voter purger, has been responsible or involved with this effort largely financed and funded by right-wing billionaires, been responsible for purging probably millions, certainly hundreds of thousands of voters off the voting rolls in Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, you know, states all over the country, and apparently in Kansas too. What happened in this primary where the Secretary of State, the guy in charge of the vote in Kansas, ran in the primary for governor?
Yeah, so it's worth mentioning that there's a lot of ways that we have voter suppression going on. The purging of voter rolls through Kansas CrossCheck, it's actually that national program. It started here in Kansas, and it used to be run in a way that was very cautious to not try to throw legitimate people off. But when Kris Kobach took over, he started using it in an incredibly irresponsible way that started purging potentially millions of people around the country. But we've also had the situation where we had proof of citizenship here, where people would have to bring in their birth certificates to be able to vote. That finally got thrown out by a federal judge just this summer. So this was actually the first election in a long time in Kansas where tens of thousands of people were allowed to vote because they ruled that they had illegally been thrown off because they didn't submit their birth certificate. But the particular problem we had here, in addition to, we don't know how many people were purged, so there's plenty of people who showed up and found out they couldn't vote because they weren't registered. But we also had a problem where different counties were choosing to reject ballots for different reasons, such as in Johnson County, where they said that 153 people, their signatures didn't match on their ballot, and so they threw those out, where other counties didn't do that.
If I may interrupt, isn't it true that in Kansas there is no state requirement that the signatures match? It's simply a practice?
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting. This is a law, go figure, written by Kris Kobach. And what it does is whenever you first request a ballot, your signature does have to match. They verify that when you request to have a mail ballot. And at that point, if your signature doesn't match, they have time to try to contact you and say, we don't think your signature matches. Was this really you? And state law does say that. But whenever you get the ballot back, whenever you send in your ballot, state law just says it has to be signed. It doesn't say they're allowed to go through the verification process because they don't have time to try to cure it.
So they're applying a stricter standard to ballots coming from counties that might have voted against Kris Kobach. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what it appears to be. And so Kansas elections are run county by county, but for the biggest counties, the Secretary of State, Mr. Kobach, appoints the people in those counties who run elections. And it seems like places where Mr. Kobach was likely to pick up votes, they had a very relaxed standard on not rejecting anyone. But in counties like Johnson County, where Mr. Collier, the current governor, was obviously the favorite, there was a very, very strict standard where they threw out lots of votes.
Was this a dictate that is documentable from Secretary of State Kobach's office to these election officials, or were they simply partisan election officials who were in the bag for Kobach and they knew what to do?
So I can't exactly say, but these are political appointments, and Ronnie Metzger, the Johnson County Elections Commissioner, in that county that should have gone more strongly for Collier, he actually was the head of the Republican Party of that county. He has deep ties to Kris Kobach. It's very questionable. And then also, because of the optics, Kris Kobach finally, at the last minute, recused himself from handling the primary, or he said he did, but now we know through the Kansas City Star did open records request, and Mr. Kobach was talking to Ronnie Metzger, the Johnson County Election Commissioner, into the AMs, I think at 1 and 3 a.m., while their system had allegedly crashed, and then we didn't get the election results till the next morning.
the system allegedly crashed. What's going on with this?
Yeah, so we had a, in Johnson County, which is the largest county in Kansas, we had new voting machines. There's an entire, it's a very dramatic situation in itself, but we had new voting machines, and they had a issue tabulating the results, and then I think it was around 3 a.m. they said they weren't going to be able to do it that night, and so they came back the next morning, and then at about 9 a.m. the next morning they told us the results. There's lots of questions about these machines, how they're handled. They don't really give voters a clear chance to verify that their votes were accurately cast. So those are under a lot of scrutiny right now. And the software company is saying that it was just a software issue.
Right. Who's the who makes these machines?
I think this is ESS, or ESS&S.
Yeah. Remarkable. Was that company has a very strange history. The Yurusevich, I believe it's pronounced, brothers who started it, and their Christian fundamentalism and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's just a whole bizarre thing. So how do you think this, two questions. How is this going to play out in Kansas? Is Kobach really in trouble, or is there just a bunch of people yelling about it, but nothing's going to happen, number one? And number two, to what extent, if we can demonstrate, or and you believe that you have demonstrated, that Kobach is actually rigging elections, it rigged his own election, to what extent is that kind of a rigging of elections, you know, kind of standard now in America? We see a number of Republican-controlled states with Republican secretaries of state, where particularly we saw this in the 2016 election, where the votes swung to Donald Trump, for example, and to Republicans in ways that were not necessarily anticipated by the pre-polling or even by the exit polls. To what extent is what we're seeing here now just this is the way we do it in America? Our election systems are no longer safe.
Well, I mean, I think that there's the legitimacy of an election has always been under question, and there's always tampering in elections. That's just a fact. It's usually people look to, they want to point at one thing, right? They want to say that it was just cross-check. It was just these signature matches. But the reality is you steal an election by 1,000 paper cuts. You get a couple votes here, a dozen votes because something happened at this polling station. And the goal is to work to remove those issues, and that's why I was raising these objections, to try to make this as best as possible. But I actually, my objection hearing was yesterday, and to begin, they decided to have the chair of my hearing was Mr. Rucker, who is a, he's donated nearly $8,000 to Kris Kobach. 2 days ago, he was in a Kris Kobach for governor t-shirt. He is Kris Kobach's subordinate, and he was the acting director of elections while Mr. Kobach recused himself. And while I made these whole points that it was a violation of due process, I couldn't get an impartial hearing if he was the chair, or if he was on the panel, let alone the chair, and he refused to recuse himself. And then I made all my objections of how, on various points, from unaffiliated voters to signature matching, state laws had been broken, U.S. constitutional precedent had been broken, and instead they heard out my objections, and then they tried to challenge my standing. They tried to kick out my case, and when they legally couldn't do that, they just, without any reasoning, they just ruled that all of my objections were denied.
Wow. Incredible. So is this dead in the water now?
So for this process, it is, yeah, three Republican operatives who somehow, I mean, it's a really awful process currently how we do this, but the only way to go forward now would be to bring a lawsuit, which I am contemplating. I'm just bringing this as a citizen, and I thought these issues had to be brought to light. I'm not positive if I'm going to bring a lawsuit yet or not, but I did see last night on the news already election officials are saying that, well, they don't think that what I brought up would have changed the outcome of election. They do think that I brought up legitimate concerns that need to be addressed. So if nothing else, there's public awareness on these issues, and I'm considering a lawsuit right now.
Wow. Well, keep us up to date, would you, Davis?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Davis Hammond. He is the an activist and founder of Loud Light. Loudlight.org is the website, an election integrity group in Kansas. Loud_light is the Twitter handle. And as I said, loudlight.org is the website. Davis, great work you're doing, and I look forward to talking with you in the future. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the news of the day. My thoughts, your thoughts, all of this stuff right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, it's 9/11. We talked about it for the whole last previous hour. We can get back around to it if you'd like. If you have thoughts or comments, give us a shout. And welcome back. Mike in Washington State, listening on KBCS. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Mike.
Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
9/11. I'm a plain liberal. I never would have voted for Republican in my life. But I think that 9/11 was a failure of the security experts in this country and politicians. It never should have happened. There was that plane that was hijacked in France in the early 90s, 93, I think. And the French realized that they were going to use that as a bomb, and they went in and killed all the hijackers. And after that, there were locks on the cockpit doors of every airplane in France. And that also was a standard procedure in Israel.
Yeah, it had been in Israel from the very beginning, Mike.
We've
got to turn up the volume on the hybrid here.
Locks on those cockpit doors, and 9/11 would never have happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And Israel had always had that, and the Europeans had that after the 80s, actually. It was in the 70s when there were all those hijackings to Cuba here in the United States. And Congress prepared, Teddy Kennedy was an advocate for this, prepared legislation to require the hardening of the cockpit doors back in the late 70s, early 80s. And the airline industry made major donations to a bunch of Republicans who fought that back. And basically said, no, we're not, you know, it ain't going to happen. We're not going to have this going on. And as a result of that, you know, we had 9/11. I mean, there was no, it was very easy to hijack a plane in the United States, uniquely. Pretty much every place else in the world had done it. And the airline industry wanted to, you know, oppose this because it would have cost them a couple $100,000 per plane to set it up, and they didn't want the expense, which is just absurd. And so, you know, these guys just, you know, walked through this hole in our security, and you know, it was absolutely unnecessary. I think, you know, Mike, spot on. Thanks for the call. Nathan in Dallas, Texas, watching us on YouTube. Hey, Nathan, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, it's 9/11. There's always this talk about 3,000 people that died. That was 17 years ago. 1 year ago, there was a hurricane. 3,000 Puerto Ricans are dead, not from hijackers, but from negligence from the man at the top. Where's that memorial?
Yeah, it's I think it's something that we all know, we all remember that George W. Bush ignored the warnings. He ignored the presidential daily briefing on August 6th. He ignored what he was told by Bill Clinton when he came into office, that bin Laden is your number one priority. He's coming to attack us on U.S. soil. Dick Cheney ignored what Al Gore told him. Or maybe they took it to heart and just decided, you know, an attack wouldn't be such a bad thing. There are people suggesting that. I'm not ready to go there yet, but,
I'm referring to the hurricane last year, 1 year ago.
Oh.
So 3,000 deaths that have happened under the Trump, because of Trump's negligence.
Oh, I see. You're talking about about Puerto Rico.
Yes.
Sorry, I missed that. I got distracted here by a text message. Spot on, Nathan. And this is something that deserves more attention, too. Thanks so much for the call. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 9/11. Today is 9/11. And just to recap, I think one of the most important clips from that era that we need to remember and we need to constantly revisit is Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers' committee that was looking into what led up to 9/11. We know Sandy Berger on this program, on this very program, that George W. Bush, Barack Obama's national security advisor, Sandy Berger, was told, excuse me, Bill Clinton's national security advisor, Sandy Berger, told explicitly to George W. Bush's national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, Bin Laden is coming to get you. This was in December and early January of 2000 and 2001, after George W. Bush was elected. The previous administration, the Clinton administration, had been for several years aware of the fact that Bin Laden was planning to strike the United States. They tried to do something about it. In the midst of his impeachment hearings, Bill Clinton fired three cruise missiles into Bin Laden's camp in Afghanistan. At that point in time, Bin Laden, about 20,000 people had been through the camp. There was an estimated 5,000, quote, hardcore Al-Qaeda fighters hanging out with Bin Laden. And that was it. In the entire world, there were 5,000 members of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda today is larger than it has ever been. It is stronger than it has ever been because of the way George W. Bush reacted to this. He could have said to the world, we are the victims of an infamous crime. This guy is not a nation. He doesn't represent a nation. He is a criminal and a madman using the Saudi interpretation of Islam, this Wahhabist interpretation of Islam. He is a Saudi citizen himself, Bin Laden, using this interpretation of Islam to justify the murder of roughly 3,000 American citizens, not to mention a lot of other people. And that's wrong. It's an insult to Islam. It's an insult to Saudi Arabia. It's an insult to the whole thing. And therefore, I, George W. Bush, following 9/11, I am asking the world community to join me and Interpol to join me in tracking down these people around the world using police action. And I am taking the offer that Mullah Omar made to me that he will arrest Bin Laden and turn him over to a third country for trial. We are going to do that. We're going to have a trial of this criminal, and we're going to put this behind us. If that had been how George W. Bush responded to 9/11, Bin Laden would have been put on trial. He would have been found guilty. Bin Laden's people would have been arrested by the government of Afghanistan and others associated with them. After 9/11, the Taliban had turned completely against Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. We had an opportunity to clean this whole thing up. And by the way, we weren't the only country to have been attacked by terrorists and to respond in the way that I'm suggesting. Back in the 80s, you had Aldo Moro, the former prime minister of Italy, was kidnapped by the Red Brigades and died in the trunk of the car that kidnapped him. I believe he suffocated. I don't recall exactly how he died, but he died. You had this group in Germany that was blowing things up. You had obviously the IRA in the UK, in England. The IRA was active there. They damn near killed Margaret Thatcher. They blew up number 10 Downing Street, or the building next door to it. So, you know, terrorism was nothing new. And the response of civilized countries to the terrorism wasn't, you know, when the IRA tried to blow up number 10 Downing Street, the British didn't say, oh, we're going to declare war on Ireland. You know, it just didn't happen. We used police. But Bush didn't want to do that because starting back in 1999, he told his biographer if he had a chance to go to war, he was going to take it. And here it is.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
And that was 2 years before 9/11. That was before George W. Bush even announced that he was going to run for president. He wanted to have a war. He thought it would be politically helpful to him. And then you look at Donald Trump back in November of 2010, tweeting that he believed that Barack Obama was going to declare a war somewhere to help him in the midterm elections, which means Trump is thinking the same way that Bush was thinking, which means we really need to be concerned. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Can you imagine how different the world would be if the Bush administration had responded to 9/11 the way that all the European governments responded when they were suffered terrorist attacks? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we're contemplating how different the world would be if George W. Bush had responded to the terror attacks by, this was not a country, this was not Pearl Harbor, this was not Japan attacking us, this was not Afghanistan attacking us, it certainly wasn't Iraq attacking us. There is some evidence that some people in Saudi Arabia were behind this attack, but I don't think it was even the Saudi government itself attacking us, although they largely supported the Wahhabists and supported Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. You know, I don't think that they specifically knew that this was going to happen. They would have realized how much blowback would come to them as a result of it. So had George W. Bush simply said, this is a crime, how different might the world be, number one. And number two, you know, the CIA finally, I mean, they were, you know, they'd gotten warnings from the Russians, from the Israelis, from the British, from the French. I believe from the Germans, I could be wrong, the major intelligence service, the Australians, major intelligence services around the world had warned the Bush administration that 9/11 was coming. And finally the CIA said, okay, that's it. He is not taking us seriously. We've got to do something. They flew an analyst down from Washington, D.C. to Crawford, Texas, all by himself. He meets with George W. Bush on the front porch of his house and says, here's your presidential daily briefing, sir. And it's headlined, Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. And George W. Bush reads it, which is more than Donald Trump does, reads it, hands it back to him and says, and pats him on the leg and says, okay, son, you covered your ass. Now you can go back to D.C. And then did nothing. Well, actually, he did something. He extended his vacation for another month, longest vacation in the history of the American presidency. He was afraid to go back to D.C. at that point because he knew that something terrible was going to happen. I don't think he knew it was going to be planes flying into buildings. I think he thought it was going to be something like a Tim McVeigh truck bomb, but he knew something terrible was going to happen. And so what did he do? He went to his brother's state. I mean, he waited for another few weeks. Still nothing happened. So finally he said, okay, screw it. I got to get out of Texas. It's starting to look weird, like I'm hiding here. And so he went to Florida, where his brother locked down the state, and there were no, you know, clear threats in Florida. And Jeb Bush declared a state of emergency, and George is sitting in the classroom reading My Pet Goat when 9/11 happens. And for 7 long minutes, he's sitting there going, holy crap, you know, I should have listened to Bill Clinton. It's really pretty breathtaking when you think about it. David in Pavel, Tennessee. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I was asking about, I just wanted to hear your thoughts about what we would have done if Al Gore had won in 2000. If the energy, if
he did win in 2000,
been in office, if we had seen someone who would have responded to this by getting us off of oil.
Yeah.
Think how different the world would be if we had seen this as a impetus, if we'd taken advantage of this crisis and used it to transition the world to green.
Well, let me step you into the Wayback Machine, David, and let's go back to 1979.
And Carter started that, yes.
The summer of 1979, here is what Jimmy Carter had to say.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And then he continues to talk about solar.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
This was 1979. He put the solar panels up on the White House. He was on the road to do this. And one of the main reasons was he did not want us to be beholden to Saudi Arabia any longer. And what did Reagan do? One of the first things he did when he came into the White House, in addition to turning the temperature down and turning and lighting up all the fireplaces, was he took the solar panels off the roof of the White House. So had Carter's legislation stood, I don't think 9/11 ever would have happened, because we wouldn't have gone into Iraq in the first place. I mean, you know, keep in mind the things that inflamed bin Laden, and bin Laden talked about this in 1998, 1999. In fact, there was a piece in the New York Times about it. Bin Laden said that he was going to strike the United States. He was going to attack us for two reasons. Number one, we had built a U.S. Air Force base in Saudi Arabia on sacred Saudi soil, and men were watching pornography and drinking alcohol, and women were driving and exposing their elbows. And that was blasphemy. And he wanted us to get rid of that Air Force base, the Bin Sultan Air Force Base, or whatever it's called, that was put there by George Herbert Walker Bush, in order to have a presence to stage the attacks against Iraq or against Kuwait, you know, Iraqi soldiers in Kuwait. We didn't dial that back. We didn't shut that Air Force base back down until 2005. George W. Bush finally did it. Said, "Okay, Bin Laden, I'll give you what you want," because he couldn't catch him, right? And then secondly, of course, Carter wanted us to no longer be dependent upon Saudi oil. So there you go, David.
Well, and when we sent the troops into Saudi Arabia, too, also, our Christian troops and our Jewish troops were not able to display any kind of religious thing. He talked about women driving Jeeps, but the women weren't allowed to drive Jeeps like they were in anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
We actually kowtowed to the Saudis in a big way.
You're absolutely right.
We put our troops and based them there. And of course, we told bin Laden to his face 2 weeks before the invasion that we would not interfere in inter-Arab relations. I forget what the exact verbiage was, but...
Yeah, not bin Laden, you're talking about Saddam Hussein. And that was, you know, April Gillespie, yes. Saddam Hussein said, "I'm thinking of invading Kuwait because they're slant drilling under us and they're stealing our oil, and I'm thinking of, and they used to be one of the states of Iraq and the 39th state, and so I'm going to return this to Iraq." And April Gillespie's response was, you know, "We won't get involved." And of course, as soon as he did it, George Herbert Walker Bush thought, I can have a 100-hour war, and we'll solve this problem, and I'll get reelected president. And you know, just like his mentor Ronald Reagan had his little war in Grenada, you know, which helped him get reelected in '84. David, spot on.
I hear say what went on in the meeting. Either we have two transcripts that have Glaspie saying exactly that we would not interfere.
Yes. Yeah, I know. And this is like, it was like almost like the whole thing was set up. Anyway, it's pretty bizarre. Ron in Benton Harbor, Michigan, we should blame Jimmy Carter for 9/11? Seriously?
Absolutely, Tom. It goes all the way back then. Jimmy Carter, first he boycotted the Olympics. Then he's the one who started minimal aid to the Mujahideen because the Soviet Union, on their own border, a border dispute between Russia and a country on their border, we stuck our nose in. There was no problem with Islam.
We did that during the Reagan administration. It was when we started, you know, Charlie Wilson's war was in the 80s. That's when we started supporting the Mujahideen, specifically Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan.
Under Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, well, it continued through the Carter presidency, but there's no way I'm going to blame Jimmy Carter for this. Come on. That's amazing. Jay in Houston, Texas. Hey, Jay, your thoughts?
Yes. One, I always think Jimmy Carter has been the best president since post-World War II.
Yeah, he's been the best president of my lifetime.
Yeah, I won't argue with that at all. Going back to 9/11, I seem to remember reading in a Greg Palast book that the New York Times was going to run a story on the 12th about voter caging and how Bush stole the election, but because of 9/11, it never happened. Do you remember anything like that? I don't know if I have a false memory of this or not.
I don't know that it was on the 12th, but I know that there was a whole spectrum of investigative reporting that had been happening throughout the summer and fall of 2001, looking into the election of 2000, because you know the newspapers were recounting the ballots, and that information came out in November of 2001. And in the pieces that were published in both the New York Times and the Washington Post, they come right out and say, by any count, by any measure, however you did the count, if you do a complete count of all the votes in Florida, Al Gore won. Now, they also point out that Al Gore's initial lawsuit was just in three counties. And if those three counties were the only ones that would have been recounted, Al Gore still would have lost. But and that became the headline, right? But, you know, the state Supreme Court of Florida required a recount of the entire state. And had that happened, then, you know, Al Gore would have been made president. It was just that simple. And that's why, you know, the lawsuit that George Bush filed with the help of Brett Kavanaugh and John Roberts said that if there was a recount of all the votes in Florida, it would cause, quote, irreparable harm to, you know, the plaintiff, George W. Bush. Patrick in Seaside, California. Patrick, we just have a half a minute. You got a quick point you want to make?
You got me up against the break.
I'm sorry.
Well, first of all,
it's that or nothing.
It's official now, living under the Trump junta. We are now all living in a Stanley Kubrick film without Peter Sellers to guide us through.
Yeah.
I think that people should remember that the Bush response to Iraq was addressed in 2008 by Vincent Bellosi's book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder.
Yes.
And I would suggest that Donald Trump's neglect of Puerto Rico after the hurricane constitutes crimes against humanity. I say most of our presidents have been mass murderers.
This is, you know, I'm with you. Well, you know, we can build a case president by president if you want, but I'm not sure how productive that is right at this point. The lessons, in my opinion, that we need to learn from 9/11 is that bombing other countries because a crime has been committed to you, not by that country, is a mistake.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to be checking in with Talk Media News after the after a short break here, about 4 minutes from now, so stick around. Welcome back. James in Spokane, Washington, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, we were trying to come up with a name for Trump, by the way. I think Potemkin Bastard probably covers it pretty good.
Yikes. Okay. I'm reluctant to call anybody a bastard. I think, you know, there are a lot of fatherless children out there. It's a slur that's way past its prime.
But Potemkin, I get. There's other definitions for the word as well, and I think they're appropriate to him.
Okay.
As a pretender, but
yeah.
Anyway, the weapons industries in this country, Tom, if their profits fall, heads are going to roll. We know that. That's a capitalist model, okay? They're going to promote war as much as they can. They're going to engineer events to the extent they can if they don't think they'll get caught. This is going to be a continuing process in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, and now you've got John Bolton in the White House. You've got a bunch of war hawks who, you know, have close ties to the weapons industry. You've got a general running the, you know, as chief of staff in the White House, you know, General Kelly. I am very, very concerned. And
industries have no conscience. They have no conscience.
Yeah, I think echoing Bob Woodward's concern is a good one right now to point out that, you know, if a disaster, if an emergency was to happen with Donald Trump in the White House, we are at considerable risk. I don't know how to say it beyond that, James, but I think that that does it. James, thanks a lot for the call. It really is a challenge that you know, we need to figure out, we need to face. I'm waiting for... Anyhow, the John Bolton, by the way, this is absolutely bizarre. The International Criminal Court that prosecuted the war criminals from Nazi Germany, the International Criminal Court. This is, you know, what John Bolton said yesterday to the right-wing Federalist Society that gave us Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas and John Roberts, and now most recently John Kavanaugh, the Federalist Society speech. He said, and I quote, "We will ban its judges and prosecutors from entering the United States. We will sanction their funds in the U.S. financial system, and we will prosecute them in the U.S. criminal system." This is the International Criminal Court that holds criminals at risk. Or, you know, holds criminals responsible, like war criminals, people who have committed crimes against humanity. And John Bolton is, we are going to imprison them. The ACLU just came out and said the Trump administration's threat to criminally prosecute and sanction international criminal court justices and prosecutors is straight out of an authoritarian playbook. The unprecedented threat comes as U.S. officials face for the first time the specter of full criminal investigation by the court for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity in Afghanistan, which is an ICC member. This misguided and harmful policy will only further isolate the United States from its closest allies and give solace to war criminals and authoritarian regimes seeking to evade international accountability. The Trump administration's unwavering campaign to undermine universal human rights must be strongly resisted to avoid further damage to the institutions that were created to protect human dignity and fight impunity. Brilliant. We're going to check in with Luke Vargas in just a moment. Stick around. We'll be right back. Let's check in with Talk Media News. This report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Loving What You Do, a new book by Ellen Ratner. On the line with us is Luke Vargas. Hey, Luke.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So, and by the way, congratulations on your wedding. You're back from your honeymoon.
Thank you very much. I know, well, we could, us Americans could take a page or two out of the playbook of European life. It's very polite.
Is that where you went?
So, I was in northern Spain in Basque country, which was just a little mini paradise, a complex region. I certainly only scraped the surface of the history of that part of the world, but it was a great place to unwind and kind of detach from the world for a few weeks.
Yeah, Louise and I have been there. It is beautiful country. So what's going on in the world today?
Well, I've been doing a little digging on this North Korean letter, which was sent to President Trump last week, and that the White House is talking more and more about. You may have covered this.
I have not.
On the show today, or maybe yesterday, but I mean, basically, we don't know the exact time this letter came, but Sarah Huckabee Sanders confirmed that it did arrive at a very rare these days White House press conference yesterday. She said that this was a, quote, very warm, very positive, end quote, letter from Kim Jong-un. Trump, in a tweet over the weekend, had said, there's nothing like good dialogue from two people that like each other, end quote. What this letter appears to have been is, you know, a note persuading the U.S. to have another face-to-face meeting with North Korea of the sort that occurred in June in Singapore. And according to Sarah Sanders, the U.S. is open to this idea and is already in the process of planning another summit. Now, one thing I'll point out that's very curious about this, and it's hard to imagine this kind of occurrence being viewed by Republicans as acceptable under, let's say, an Obama presidency. But when pressed if the White House would release this letter from Kim Jong-un so we could get a little bit of a better sense of what his exact intentions are, how he might be trying to use, you know, sort of the art of persuasion to move Trump's hand on the negotiations, the White House responded and said, no, actually, the president needs Kim Jong-un's permission to publish this letter, which is a very unusual thing when it comes to these sorts of, you know, at diplomatic outreaches.
Yeah.
Let's say this. One thing we've also been seeing from the North Koreans, which sort of helps us get a sense of what they might be wanting here, were statements last week from Kim Jong-un. There was a big military parade. He gave a speech, and he said at a separate event on the sidelines of a meeting with the South Koreans last week that, look, the North Korea is open to denuclearization by 2020. And he specifically said, this is not just, you know, putting a, you know, two and two together. He said, we're open to finishing the denuclearization before the end of President Trump's first term. And it was very interesting to watch at a rally in Montana several days ago, the president really responding to this note from Kim Jong-un saying, look, you know, he said, look, President Trump, I want to get this done by your first term. And I think that has made experts understandably wary here that what Kim is trying to do is be more explicit than he was in Singapore and say, look, I'm going to hand you this political win, Mr. Right. Trump, or at least the appearance of a win, perfectly timed for your reelection if you move first. And the North Koreans have made very clear that they do not want to play by the U.S. timeline, the U.S. timeline being something that folks like John Bolton, Mike Pompeo have upheld in recent months, which is that basically we're not willing to give an inch more to North Korea until they start handing us something in return. We're waiting on the top demand, it seems to be at this point, is that North Korea would hand over some sort of detailed accounting of their nuclear stockpile so we can cross-reference it with our intelligence and suss out whether they're being honest or not. They haven't budged on that. And yet Kim Jong-un is responding to this sort of breakdown in the diplomacy by saying, look, I'm going to deliver this big political win, and likely what he wants in return is the U.S. to announce an end to the 1953 Korean War, something that, again, the U.S. has said we're not going to do unless we see any progress from their side. So, you know, this looks like another bid, I think, probably by Kim Jong-un to seize upon a weak domestic political moment for President Trump, try to tease for him the prospect of a flashy foreign policy victory, which was sort of the prelude to the talks in Singapore. I think this would probably make hardliners within the Trump administration nervous that once again, just as we've seen the U.S. sort of be split from South Korea on some of this diplomacy before, that might be happening again.
Trump might sell out our allies. Wow. So what else is going on in the world, Luke?
I will say one thing briefly. I know we just got about a minute left, but a new report from The Guardian has found that going through a list of 1,000 Twitter accounts that the U.S. government had identified as being created by this Russian troll farm, the Internet Research Agency, that those accounts have been cited in more than 100 articles by the international news media. One account in particular, someone posing as a Black Lives Matter activist under the hashtag Remove Trump Now, with a photo of Michelle Obama as their handle, was cited by 9 different outlets, including BuzzFeed, The Daily Mail, another account by the BBC, The Guardian, and The Telegraph. And sites like BuzzFeed, I'll say in particular, appear to be very vulnerable to this. Sites that just sort of curate people's opinions and stash them next to a news item. BuzzFeed keeps coming up here again and again. So takeaway in 10 seconds is, let's do real news, talk to real experts, but just sort of curating people's hot takes is entertainment, not news. And you see where the vulnerabilities lie.
Fascinating stuff. Luke Vargas with Talk Media News, talkmedianews.com. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Tom. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, great talking with you. And welcome back. Glad to have you back. We'll be back. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.